This is Ringo, and I'm just saying cheerio to all you Radio London listeners, because as you know, we're going off the air. It's a bit of a pity, and the radio will never be the same, but it's one of those things. Cheerio.
Mention has been made of the fact that mine was the first voice to be heard on Radio London. It will also be the last in regrettably few minutes from now. Big L time is 3 o'clock and Radio London is now closing down.
I'm Ray Clark. In March 2004, I produced an award-winning documentary to commemorate the start of the British offshore radio stations 40 years earlier. The programme was called All at Sea. Now, 3 years on, BBC Essex is marking the 40th anniversary of the introduction of the law that aimed to close down those radio stations, most of them off the coast of Essex. They were listened to by millions. All at Sea, Part 2, August the 14th. What happened next goes back to 1967, as the pirate stations were headed for stormy waters.
Wonderful Radio London, news around the clock.
Broadcasting, it is almost certain that the Marine Offenses Bill designed to stop offshore radio will come into force tomorrow. As a result, Radio London will be closing down at 3 o'clock this afternoon.
I pulled my car off and I just started to cry. I was blubbing. And I heard knock on the window, and there was this cop, because I was right outside the Savile Row police station. And the policeman said to me, "Are you all right, sir?" And I said, "Yes." I said, "Pirate radio, some big L's just getting there." "Oh, that's quite all right, sir. Could you move along, please?" It was wonderful.
That was awful. It was just terrible to think that they were going to be gone and not heard of again. It was all very emotional.
I guess we didn't think they could possibly take them away from us, the politicians. There were so many people listening. There was such a groundswell saying, "This is great, this is what we want." But of course, behind the scenes, the politicians were saying, "Oh no, these people can't have this, too much freedom, we can't control it." So, yeah, eventually we heard this Marine Offences Broadcasting Act, as it became, was going to shut them all down. And that was it, shut them all down.
For more than 3 years, the radio pirates had blasted the British Isles with their ammunition of non-stop pop music. But on August the 14th, 1967, the government fired back.
I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade. And though the news was rather sad,
you imagine today's teenagers having all their radio stations or their MP3 players taken away from them?
That's Paul Peters, who, like many thousands of youngsters at the time, including me, was bitter at the idea of the pirate radio stations being taken off the air. Many of the listeners joined organisations set up to fight the government ban. And the radio stations themselves warned of a bleak future for the hundreds of thousands of pop music lovers.
You have been found guilty of listening to an offshore commercial station. This is your 59th offence. Therefore, your punishment must be severe. I sentence you to listen to the BBC Light for the rest of your life.
Anything but that!
Order! Order! Any more of this contempt of court, and it will be the Home Service. That's better.
The Free Radio Association was set up as a body to try and fight the government, to persuade the government not to go ahead with the Marine Offences Broadcasting Act, which was intended to close down all of the offshore radio stations. Sadly, we failed. And on the 14th of August, as a sort of finale, I suppose, to the whole thing, some friends and myself borrowed a coffin from an undertaker and marched up Whitehall with this coffin, took it to number 10 Downing Street. You could walk right up to the front door in those days, plonk the coffin down on the doorstep and banged on the knocker. And we handed in, I forget how many names there were, it was something like 30,000, I believe, names and addresses on petitions. The policeman who was standing at the side of the door said, "Oi, shift that, you can't leave that there." And I turned to him and said, "Well, we can't, I know we can't. We've got to go back to the undertakers in the morning."
A Sunday morning, bright and clear.
After Radio London's closed down at 3 o'clock, the disc jockeys came ashore, eventually arriving in London to be met by thousands of pirate radio fans. Radio London disc jockey Keith Skews was there.
The fans had come from all over the British Isles to welcome the DJs back, and they arrived in the evening, and it was just bedlam. The fans just went berserk. It didn't matter who you were. If you were a pirate disc jockey, great. We're going to mob you. We're going to take a lock of your hair or whatever. And I ended up in the ladies' loo, which was another thing I tend to make a habit of at Liverpool Street Station.
The government had made noises about a new BBC pop service, but at this time, we didn't know the details. And besides, it wouldn't start as soon as the pirates were closed down.
We skip the life and then go.
It seemed that everyone just wanted the pirate stations to continue. Here's Frieda Willingham from Braintree.
You had to tune into your pirates every day, every night, and listen to all the latest happenings of their lives, as well as the music that was ongoing, and keep track of who was on the boat and who wasn't. That was sort of the topic of the day with your mates at school.
Kerry Hart and her friends were growing up and listening in Ilford.
My life revolved around pirate radio, being a teenager. Me and my best friend, Pat, we went out and saw them on the boat, and used to go and see Johnny Walker wherever he was, and it was just a great time.
The news that the pirate stations were to close was heartbreaking.
Oh, I felt terrible. I cried and I cried, and I prayed that they wouldn't.
Jackie Dunn from Colchester was another heartbroken teenager.
I think it was like mourning a friend, really. It was really very, very sad time. I wrote to the Prime Minister at the time, who was Harold Wilson, on, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 occasions. Obviously, it didn't work. His office used to reply, just sort of, "Thank you for your letter," but they couldn't sort of comment on, you know, individual issues. So that was about the reply that you got every time. You know, but everybody knew you had written, because the letter that came back had Prime Minister's written all over the envelope. So people sort of asked why you had a letter from the Prime Minister, and you would tell them, and very supportive people, you know, "Oh, well, you know, perhaps we could do something to get Caroline to stay."
It was obvious that the government had no intention of allowing so-called free radio, commercial radio, to come to Britain in 1967. But before the Radio London crew had arrived at London's Liverpool Street station, two Caroline disc jockeys had left for Harwich, Robbie Dale and Johnny Walker. Caroline was to continue after August the 14th.
We present!
He's here, he's there, he's everywhere.
Now, the decision to continue broadcasting
passed August 1967. That was made by Ronan O'Reilly. I was totally supportive of his decision and his determination to continue. There was an amazing buzz in the air and the excitement was unbelievable.
Johnny Walker.
I thought, well, if Radio Caroline is going to carry on, I definitely want to be a part of it. It was just the most exciting times of all. It was, they were, I think, Caroline's finest hours after August 67. And I'm very proud, and always will be for the rest of my days, that I was a part of that. And never had any regrets. I mean, if I had decided not to stay with Caroline and to join the BBC in the beginning, I think I would at least once a week, I would have been regretting the decision not to stick in there.
This is Radio Caroline. It is now 12 midnight.
We were, concerned to a degree, concerned about the possibility of the seriousness of the ramifications that we could face. But I was convinced that the Wilson Labour government of the day wouldn't move against the ships aggressively. Public opinion was on our side.
There's definitely a principle that here we have something that is not doing harm to anyone. And all that baloney the government put out about blocking emergency frequencies and all that was just all hogwash. It really was. And so I thought it was a very important point of principle. They were wonderful times. Wonderful times.
Radio Caroline would like to extend its thanks to Mr. Harold Wilson and his Labour government for at last, after over 3.5 years of broadcasting, recognising this station's legality. It's right to be here. It's right to be broadcasting to Great Britain and the continent. It's right to give the music and service to the peoples of Europe, which we have been doing since Easter Sunday, 1964. And we, in turn, recognize your right as our listener to have freedom of choice in your radio entertainment, and of course that Radio Caroline belongs to you. It is your radio station, even though it costs you nothing. And as we enter this new phase in our broadcasting history, you naturally have our assurance that we intend to stay on the air because we belong to you and we love you. Caroline, continue.
They made you feel like you were part of their family. And they were just so special the way that they sort of treated their listeners. And, you know, it was just something special that no other radio station had, and they just made you feel welcome when you listened to them.
And of course we didn't know if the Navy would get involved in shutting them down, but yes, they continued, and I guess we all thought, oh, they're here to stay.
And we all tried to support Caroline to keep them going.
Caroline listeners Kerry Hart, Mick Elbourne and Jackie Dunn.
You're listening to All at Sea, Part 2, August the 14th. What happened next? From BBC Essex.
Pirate BBC Essex.
This is Radio Caroline International, the home of the British
explosion.
This is the Roger Day Show.
They did point out, you know, that you realise you'd be risking a heavy fine and a period in jail. I said, yeah, but it's a matter of principle, isn't it? They can do what they like to me, but they're not going to scare me off. We were on our own, and we had every listener that was going. It's fantastic. It must have had the largest commercial radio audience that was ever been, because all the Radio London people would have flicked onto us, because basically there wasn't anything else. It was still the old light programme in those days.
It's all too beautiful.
The man who started Radio Caroline was an Irishman, Ronan O'Reilly. Here, from a BBC interview in 1967, he outlines the plans for Caroline's survival.
As far as the public is concerned, they will think there has been no change. But in fact, supplies will be coming from other places than Britain. Advertising will be coming from other countries than British. They cannot be British companies. But I would say in a year's time, Caroline will be stronger than ever.
The charismatic Ronan O'Reilly was the public face of the station. But the financial power was in the hands of a hard-headed businessman from the music world, Phil Solomons. Mr. Solomons also ran Major Minor Records, whose artists were played regularly after August the 14th.
Another great record from Major Minor.
In his first ever interview about his involvement, he explained to me how Caroline was kept afloat after August the 14th. when it became illegal for British companies to advertise on the station.
We did a deal with the record companies and the owners of the records and the managers and the agents that we would give them so many plugs per week for £100.
Mr. Solomons also revealed how the company continued to operate.
So I moved the operation to Dublin, and they had a man there called Charlie Hockey. He was the teacher, and Charlie Hockey was very sympathetic, because anything that he could do to damage the British government, he was happy to do. So when we said we needed time, he said, run the operation from here. Every time the British government asked for us to pass a law, I would get one of my people in the Parliament to put a private member's bill in, and it means that the British request would go to the bottom of the pile again.
As listeners, we were blissfully unaware of the political dealings. We just wanted to support the disc jockeys fighting against the odds, 3 miles out to sea, to bring us the latest pop music.
This is a story of man's fight for freedom. The beginning is in the past, the middle is now, the end is in the future. It is a story of sadness and of triumph. August the 14th, as disc jockeys Robbie Dale, Johnny Walker and Ross Brown leave Liverpool Street, London.
In the early days after August the 14th, Mother Nature seemed to be against us. We had the terrible winter, and it was like Caroline had been forgotten. And I thought, I heard this record by Sergeant Barry Sadler, which was a pro-Vietnam War record, but there's an instrumental on the B-side, and I loved the way it kind of built up and built up. So I sat up one night and I just wrote this positive dream of Caroline actually winning and sailing up the Thames and being welcomed in a legitimate radio station. And I think I went a bit over the top on the sort of Churchillian acting performance in doing this, so I find it a bit embarrassing to listen to now. But at the time, it was just a good morale booster for us on the ship, I think, and for the listeners, you know, just to give them, just to emphasize something positive. And it just became known as Man's Fight for Freedom.
It was just particularly about a rather grand speech that Johnny Walker made, saying how they were determined to carry on.
The seas are rough and cruel, life is hard, but as each day passes, the moment of triumph grows nearer. The British people rally round. They send food, they send comfort, and they send their love. All you need is love, and love overcomes. The British government relents. Caroline raises her anchor and heads for England.
In the days and weeks that followed, we were really kept very busy with the job that we had in hand, and a lot of us were doing double and triple shifts at the time. One rather interesting event that took place was a fishing boat turned up from Frinton or somewhere like that, brought records and news of what was happening ashore, and cash for everyone, a little bonus from Phil Solomon.
London skyline has a new landmark pointed toward the heavens. Caroline's Ariel. At last, beaming out its love and music to a free and peaceful nation. We have overcome. The battle is over. Free radio becomes a way of life, but never taken for granted. For no man will ever forget Monday, August the 14th, 1967.
Good morning, everybody. It's 6:30 and the BBC Life programme's beginning another day's broadcasting. Now, until 8:30, we have our programme of morning music.
But things were about to change in Portland Place. Auntie BBC would never be quite the same again. The UK's new pop music service was to be on 247 metres medium wave, but it was to be called Radio 1.
The BBC is simply, madly, divinely, happily, completely in love with music. Music loving, keys, skews on 247 Radio 1.
I don't ever remember doing an audition, to be honest, for Radio 1 as such. And suddenly there I was interviewed by a number of people, a bit like a BBC Board of Governors nowadays. And Mr. Skewes, you have the name Cardboard Shoes. Do I call you Mr. Skewes, or can I call you Cardboard? You have GCE in woodwork. Well, that is marvellous, you know. What good will that be in the future phase of Radio 1, do you think?
Emperor Roscoe!
Nobody knew what Radio 1 was. We heard rumors. But the BBC, I mean, the stigma of joining the BBC was so anti-pirate. It took a little bit of convincing that we were going to be, okay. I was in the studio in Paris at the time on Radio Luxembourg, French Radio Luxembourg. Derek Chinnery showed up, and Derek was the emissary from the BBC. And Derek said, I say, old chap, and BBC, and I'm going, what is this all about? You know, I was in the heyday. I was nuts back then. I was as crazy as anybody. You know, between the success and the money and the women and the freedom that we had back then compared to now, I was a lunatic. And here's this fellow with a tie, BBC demeanor. And I'm going, what? We stayed in touch, and a little bit later on, they said, I can't remember the time, they said, your first show will be airing on Saturday midday, da-da-da-da-da, on this station. And I went, okay. And I said, how many DJs? 26, I think they had. 26 disc jockeys.
Radio 1! Tony Blackburn!
A guy called Teddy Warwick from the BBC said to me, he said, you know, if you ever want to come to the BBC, there will be a place for you here. And about that time I met a very, very wonderful man called Harold Davison, and Harold became rather like a father to me, really. He said, if you would like to sign with me, I'll make you the top disc jockey in 3 months. There's a station called Radio 1 which is going to open up. The Light Programme would like to use you on a programme called Midday Spin. And it was a tryout, really, for The Breakfast Show on Radio 1. And so I did actually leave the ships just before the Marine Offences Bill went through, because I could see there was going to be a terrific rush there. And when somebody comes up to you and says, I'll make you the top disc jockey in 3 months, it's quite a thing to have somebody say to you. He did it, actually, in about 2 months. And I went to the BBC, and I liked it there very much.
In very little time now, it will be my pleasure and privilege to launch Radio 1 and 2. All of us here who have worked so hard during these past weeks have done so with two principal aims in view: to provide you with a better service of popular music and a greater measure of choice. A good deal of publicity has surrounded the plans for Radio 1, because in many ways it represents a new concept for BBC Radio. Radio 1 is designed to be young in heart and in style. And Radio 2 is much more than the old Light programme shed of its 247-metre wavelength. But now, with the clock ticking slowly up to 7 a.m., it's going to be time to welcome Radio 1's first early show on 247 meters medium wave, whilst Breakfast Special continues on Radio 2. 10 seconds to go before Radio 1, Tony Blackburn, and Radio 2, Paul Hollingdale, stand by for switching. Get tuned to Radio 1 or 2, 5, 4, 3. Radio 2, Radio 1, go.
The voice of Radio 1. Just for fun.
Music.
Too much.
And good morning, everyone. Welcome to the exciting new sound of Radio 1.
When I opened up Radio 1, it was with a certain sadness, because I thought the idea of being out on the pirate ships was not to bring about the start of Radio 1. It was really to bring about commercial radio, and that's what I really wanted to happen. So therefore, although I opened up Radio 1, and it's something that I'm very grateful for, but it really wasn't what the whole operation was about.
Yes, indeed, we've even got Arnold back. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first of the Tony Blackburn shows. I shall be waking up every morning, except Sunday, between 7 and 8.30. So let's away!
We all thought, there's no way we'll ever listen to Radio 1.
Woke up one morning, half asleep, with all my blankets in a heap, and yellow roses scattered all around.
It was like the enemy. I think we thought we would be disloyal to the pirates if we ever tuned into Radio 1.
Didn't really listen to Radio 1 a great deal, because it wasn't our thing. You know, we were used to the music that Caroline played, and I suppose Caroline was much more relaxing station to listen to. Radio 1 was a bit sort of, you know, straight-laced, I suppose you could say. Not the same banter of words that, you know, the stories and things. And the music wasn't the same.
I never did listen to radio again, really, from then, because nothing was as good. But never did listen to Radio 1.
Never. Simple. I've never tuned any of my radios into Radio 1. My kids might have, but I never did, and never will.
Radio 1 is wonderful.
For many, compared to the pirates, Radio 1 was far from wonderful. And it would seem that many already within the BBC were less than keen on this new service. Veteran newsreader Brian Perkins witnessed the arrival of the new radio station.
Bearing in mind at that time, the BBC was manned by, I mean, particularly in the hierarchy, was from a completely different age. Many of them were ex-army, and the whole place was run on regimental lines. And I think they really, quite honestly, didn't know what had struck them when Radio 1 took off. But some of the older people felt it quite demeaning, I think, and they were a little taken aback at having to read the news in the context of what they considered to be wild pop songs.
If you're going to San Francisco.
Throughout the winter of 1967, Radio Caroline continued to compete against Radio 1, which by now was establishing itself as Britain's pop music station. But on reflection, it was clear that the odds were stacked against Caroline continuing. The end came in March 1968 when the ships, both of them, the North Ship and the South Ship, were towed in. Disc jockeys Andy Archer, Roger Day and Johnny Walker were on board at the time.
I remember the last program I did for Radio Caroline. It was midnight to two. Carl Mitchell, who normally did the program between midnight and two, was off. And it was the one program we all enjoyed doing because after 12, you didn't have to play plug records. So you could play some fantastic songs between 12 and two. And it was a real pleasure, you know, just to go on and have free choice for a couple of hours. But I'm always rather sad because, I mean, I'd played some pretty good music on that last night. I remember playing songs by The Doors and Love and a few other of the West Coast bands. But just as a bit of a joke, I played the number one record of the day to finish, which was Cinderella Rockefeller by Esther and Abby Oferim, which is probably one of the worst records ever made. And that, strange enough, was the last record that was ever played on Radio Caroline. And not knowing that, of course, went to bed, and about 4 o'clock in the morning, we were all woken up when this huge tug tied alongside. It was a tug called the Titan.
And our captain came in with the captain of the tug and said, you've got 5 minutes to clear out the studio. So, well, can't I make any announcement or anything? And this big crewman stood by me, so I guess I couldn't. So we went out of the studio, the locked studio, and cut the anchor chain, and we were off. And I think we kind of knew that that was it. We didn't know why they'd done what they'd done. We didn't know about the bad debts and all that sort of thing. So it was an awful trip. That was the lowest moment because there were a lot of tears shed. Got to be honest about it, because we had this feeling that that was it. And once we were in Holland, we weren't coming out again.
I mean, we knew there'd been financial problems between Philip Solomons and Ronan and the people that were supplying the tenders and keeping the ships afloat, basically, but we hadn't realised it was so serious as this.
39 years on, I asked Philip Solomon, the money man behind Caroline at the time, just why the Caroline ships had closed down.
I haven't a clue. I honestly couldn't answer that. I think they needed a new bottom of the boat, for one thing.
There'd been suggestions that bills to the tender company weren't paid. Were you aware of that?
No, I was not aware of that.
I knew all of that day when the boat was being towed over, I knew there was thousands of people turning on their radios and not hearing anything and fiddling with the tuning knob, thinking, well, what's happened to Caroline, you know? Has it shifted frequency, or is it just off for a couple of hours? Will it be coming back? And them not knowing what was happening, I thought that was the most awful thing. I mean, not for us to be there 1 minute happy and doing the programmes as we've always done them, and the next day dead silent. I was terribly upset about that we didn't have a chance to say goodbye or thanks for everything in the past, but that's it.
Very sad. desperately sort of looking up and down the wave band to see if it was perhaps appearing somewhere else, and couldn't actually believe that it was never going to be heard again.
Them all.